We'd like to take a second to thank our sponsor, Mouser Electronics. Not only does Mouser stock the world's widest selection of semiconductors and electronic components, they also offer an original content series called Empowering Innovation Together. Each month, EIT takes a deep dive into the hottest tech trends, and this month the focus is on AI and edge computing. Check out podcasts, articles, infographics, video, and more at mouser.com/empowering-innovation.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardwar.
I'm Reviews Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, billionaires in space.
Oi, oi, oi.
Say it like pigs in space. And Windows in the cloud. We'll be chatting about the new space race between Virgin Galactic and Jeff Bezos' Blue Origins. We have a special guest on. And we'll be chatting about Microsoft's new service, Windows 365. Windows in the cloud. Kind of crazy. There's a lot to dive into there. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget podcast, please be sure to subscribe on your podcatcher of choice, leave us a review on iTunes, and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. You can also find us every Thursday on the Engadget YouTube channel, typically around 10 a.m. Eastern, where we live stream the show. So you could chat with us. We'll do some Q&A with the audience, and that's always fun. So it's a fun interactive experience. Join us if you can. So last weekend, Richard Branson, the founder of Virgin Galactic, touched the edge of space in the first fully crewed Virgin Galactic flight to actually reach orbit. That's Unity 22. And this kicks off a wave of news, and, you know, it's a bit of a space race because Jeff Bezos' Blue Origins also is going to be launching a tourist flight on July 20th. We talked last week about the kind of like bad blood between them at this point. So we want to break down what's going on, and we brought on Tarek Malik, the editor-in-chief of Space.com, to help us figure out everything going on. Hey, Tarek.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having us here.
So what's going on? Can you give us like a brief sense of like what was so important about this Virgin Galactic flight? We've been hearing about it for years. There was like a very, you know, there was a crash, I think around 2015 too. Like this is a long story that got us here. What's important about this flight and what's happening now with this billionaire space race?
Yeah, so to kind of understand where Virgin Galactic is coming from, we have to go back in time about 17 years. And in 2004, in Mojave, California, you know, a home to test pilots and aerospace researchers galore, there was a race for a private spaceship. And that race, called the Ansari X Prize, was won by a progenitor of Virgin Galactic's own ship called Spaceship One. And it was built by a different company, Scaled Composites. And Richard Branson was really taken by that. Mm-hmm. And I believe he was there at the time watching it happen. And he said, as everyone was celebrating that win by in that event, that he was going to found Virgin Galactic and he was going to launch a passenger space line. Anyone that could afford a ticket would be able to go. Back then, tickets were a little bit cheaper. They were like $200,000. Now they're $250,000. And hey, they could be launching by the end of that decade. Now, that was 2004.
Yeah. I remember us saying at the time, like, Richard Branson, sure, bro, sure, whatever you're saying. Yeah, consumer flights to space, we'll believe it when we see it, right?
And Richard Branson, big showman, lots of deep pockets. You know, this is in 2004, SpaceX was just 2 years old. Blue Origin, working very quietly, was 4 years mm-hmm. old, but mm-hmm. no one really knew what they were doing. And so we saw over the time them make a lot of successes, like they rolled out the spacecraft. It was called Enterprise, a nod to NASA's first space shuttle, and of course, my favorite, the USS Enterprise up there. and everything seemed to be going well. Now they did have a test on the ground kill three employees of that company, Scaled Composites, which designed mm-hmm. Spaceship Two. That was a setback to understand, like, what are they doing wrong on the ground? And then in 2014. After several rocket-powered tests, they had this fatal crash that nearly sidelined them, in which basically a pilot, one of the co-pilots, unlocked a mechanism in the tail too early when the rocket engine was still on, and the spacecraft broke apart. And it was just a tragic accident. One pilot killed, one seriously injured. It could have basically canceled the company. They could have had to shut down because of that. They were able to understand like what went wrong, identify how to fix it. So now that can't ever happen again. That mechanism cannot physically be unlocked by a pilot early. And they built a new ship, that's Unity, with all of these new safety enhancements. In that time, they began testing it. They moved to New Mexico in the deserts near Truth or Consequences and Las Cruces. There's a spaceport there out in the middle of the desert called Spaceport America. And they built, it looks like a UFO if you see it from above. It's this weird kind of undulating disc-shaped thing. There's a big hangar on the bottom floor for Spaceship Two. And it's huge carrier plane, White Knight. Richard Branson named it after his mother, that carrier plane, VMS Eve. And then on top is a world-class kind of flight terminal, which I guess first-class passengers would expect if they're paying $250,000.
This is the world's first consumer spaceport, basically, right? It's an airport, but for space.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So they call it Gateway to Space, this terminal, like lots of world-class facilities. Apparently not a hotel yet, but you can imagine that might be coming. So the stage was really set. And at space.com, we have been writing since the early 2000s that this next year could be the year for commercial spaceflight.
This is your white whale, basically. Like, you guys have been following this forever.
It was almost a running joke. It's like, are we going to write that story again this year? And it's like, well, they could do it this year. Let's try. And what's happened is that I can say definitively now, I feel comfortable saying it, that 2021 is the year that true commercial spaceflight is here, because we've gotten to a point where now Virgin Galactic has launched their first fully crewed flight, not just test pilots, not just engineers, although there were some on this flight.
The founder of the company, a big deal. Yeah.
Astronaut 001 is Richard Branson's number at the company. So he's the first one to go. And then we have this whole race that came up, because while it was exciting to see Virgin Galactic make this big milestone, and they say that they could launch passengers as early as 2022 now. I heard Ashton Kutcher might actually have a flight too. And Elon Musk, who apparently has put a deposit down too. Yep. They weren't the first ones to announce they were going to launch people this year. In May, Jeff Bezos and his Blue Origin company said, hey, everyone, we're going to launch we're going to launch our first crewed flight on July 20th. And then later they launched an auction to sell off seats to go. Then they said Jeff Bezos is going to go. Then they said an aerospace or aviation pioneer, Wally Funk, is going to go. And then on July 1st, when we knew all of those details and they'd sold the trip for $28 million or so, Virgin Galactic says, we're going to launch Richard Branson to space.
Love it.
A full 9 days earlier, 10 days earlier, and stealing the thunder away. So
I would pay to see Jeff Bezos at that moment when he saw that news. Like, man, because he stepped down from being Amazon CEO, right? Like, I think he kind of did things like, just in case anything bad happens, Amazon doesn't like fall apart. But he's no longer the CEO, right? He's a chairman, or he's on the board, because he's fully focused on his rockets now, his shiny rockets. Yeah,
that's right. You know, and also because, you know, Blue Origin had this really kind of steady, but maybe not launching as quickly as rocket fans we would like, because everyone loves to see rockets go up and down over and over, you know, different kinds of vehicles launching into space. I think maybe we got a bit spoiled by SpaceX launching a rocket every week, or sometimes twice a week. Right. And so we were wondering, like, what's going on with this flight program. Now, Blue Origin has launched this vehicle 15 times, you know, and the same one over and over again. And so we expect it, you know, if they feel that it's safe enough, this is going to go just fine. In fact, back in April, they launched what they call the astronaut dress rehearsal, where they had people walk up the 7 flights of stairs. There isn't an elevator at SpaceX's, at Blue Origin's launch pad. There's a 7 a story staircase that...
Listen, I lived in New York. I know what that's like. Yeah.
That's right. Well, but this is like an ultimate walk-up that's going to kick you off the planet, I suppose. And so they had astronauts, their test astronauts go inside, sit inside, kind of do all the things you would do before countdown. And then before launch, they got off and they launched the rocket. It went fine. And when it landed, they had astronauts get back inside as if they just landed and go through all of the motions again. That was a flawless flight when they did it. And so we expect to see something like that now. The big question, and this is something that I'm very eager to see in this kind of billionaire matchup of whose space company is going to get the most customers, is when we saw Virgin Galactic's big launch, we saw a lot of flair about what that experience as a customer is going to be like. You know, you've got your personal spacesuits. You've got from Under Armour, right? You have your Land Rover drive to the spaceport. We already talked about their really awesome terminal, and then you have this brand new ship which has a cabin with a tailored seat, and you can float around. We know now what that looks like for a passenger. We really don't for Blue Origin. I mean, they have
it's also like very different ships, right? Can you just like break that down really quickly? Like Blue Origin is a rocket. Imagine a rocket. That is what it is. The Virgin Galactic ship is a space plane. You know, it just looks like a fancy plane. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So this has actually added some tension between these two companies. Mm-hmm. We actually saw before the Virgin Galactic launch last, I think like a few week, days before that Blue Origin kind of put a couple of infographics out to take a little swipe at Virgin Galactic. They did cheer them on and laud their success and sent congratulations, but it's clear that they are offering a different product. So we'll start with Virgin Galactic. As you mentioned, it's a space plane that is tucked underneath the belly of a carrier plane, and it basically takes off from a runway, goes up to about 50,000 feet, and there the pilots on the carrier plane drop it. It kind of goes in free fall for a few seconds, lights a rocket motor at the back. It's a hybrid engine that uses kind of liquid and solid propellant to go into space. That rockets away, then they turn it, the pilots aboard make it go straight up. It can cross a 50-mile border that NASA and the FAA and the U.S. military all cite as the border of space. And for Branson's flight, he got about 53 miles up. They get about 4 minutes of weightlessness. They can get out, move up the cabin, float around, look out all these round portals that are all around the cabin. And then they get back in, they buckle in, and they glide back to a runway landing at the same place that they took off from. So they can kind of go have a drink at their terminal, have a big party. So
this whole thing is it lasts, what, 15 minutes? Like, what is the length of this flight, right?
It's about an hour and a half, right? Okay. So it's an hour or so to get up to altitude, and then they wait, and then they launch it, and then about a half an hour after that, they're back on the ground gliding, and then a little bit longer for the carrier plane to get back as well. So you get a kind of a nice day outing out of it.
Sure.
The Blue Origin experience is about 11 minutes because it's a rocket. Mm-hmm. So in West Texas now, this is a really remote part of Texas. The nearest town is Van Horn. They have built this test facility with a launch pad and a landing pad. And the rocket, as I mentioned, is 7 stories tall. And on the top is a capsule, much like NASA's early Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo vehicles, and SpaceX's Dragon. Capsule. It also does not go all the way to orbit, but it actually goes a lot higher than Virgin Galactic. So this rocket can launch vertically with the capsule on top and the astronauts on board. It launches them up above a 62-mile altitude. Now, that is an internationally recognized border for where space begins, and the effects of the atmosphere are negligible. The capsule separates from the rocket booster, and it keeps going up on a ballistic trajectory like you've thrown a softball, basically. And the booster comes back to the Earth, lands vertically on a landing pad, and then Blue Origin can kind of go out, clean it up, gas it up again, and get it ready for the next flight. The capsule keeps going up, hits that kind of physical apex, and then falls back down. It has a heat shield like SpaceX and NASA, and it touches down on the ground. So it's got some retro rockets, much like what Russia's Soyuz capsules do with these parachutes. And then Blue Origin runs out with some trucks to recover the crew, get them out. And then I'm sure that they have a party afterward. There isn't a great big world-class terminal out there yet. Because Blue Origin hasn't built one. They've been focusing on getting the rocket ready. So we're going to see on July 20th with that flight what that experience is going to be like for these people. And they auctioned off, so launching on this flight, because that'll last 11 minutes. They'll have about 3, maybe 4 minutes of weightlessness as well. They have the biggest windows, by the way, Blue Origin, ever to fly in space. It's like a floor-to-ceiling window, but on a spaceship. and there's one of those at every seat on the vehicle. So
that was in the comparison chart. We got big windows.
Yeah. And so you would think that wouldn't be a big deal, but if you think, I'm on this really short flight, I want to see what Earth looks like. It's going to be really easy because the window is right there. You don't have to unbuckle and then look at, oh, do I want to look at this little round window or this round window? It's clear, you know, where to look. And we're sure that there's probably going to be some other amenities. Like, both of these companies have live recording going on. They're recording everyone's reactions. You can expect that the customers are going to get some tailored videos and other souvenirs of their experience. But they are truly different vehicles. Mm-hmm. They're a different experience. And I can see the Jet Set folks that really want to rack up both clout and
version points. Yeah.
Yeah. That you could see them, you know, booking a trip on both of these things and then comparing them after. Like, you know, Charles Simone, you mentioned Windows earlier. Charles Simone booked not one, but two trips to orbit on the International Space Station with Russia and a company called Space Adventures. So there are people that want to do it more than once. And both of these companies, with their reusable aspects, kind of are poised to do that. SpaceX as well. Well, you know, we've talked mostly about Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin, but Elon Musk has already been launching people into orbit, not just 62 miles
to the ISS,
to the International Space Station. He's booked a flight for September 15th to launch another billionaire, Jared Isaacman, and three other civilians into orbit, not to the space station. They're just going to stay in orbit for about 5 days or so and come back. But that is a sea change now, because all other private orbital flights have gone to the space station, were launched by Russia on their Soyuz vehicle, and were brokered by a U.S. company. This is a company not just brokering the deal, but inviting them out, giving them spacesuits, launching them in orbit.
The full service experience. Tarek, I have many follow-up questions, but I want to ask for Lynn. Do you have anything you want to jump in?
Yeah. I have at least two follow-up questions for Tarek. One thing is, I didn't know if you were building to this, but the price difference between the two, right? I mean, they're very different experiences, but how much does each cost?
So that is actually the $250,000 question, Jared, because we know for a long time that Virgin Galactic was at the $200,000 to $250,000 range. That price could change over time. They might they might increase it. You know, you can kind of jump ahead in line if you pay an extra service fee, because they do have hundreds of reservations. We don't know how much Blue Origin is going to charge. They auctioned off the seat to space with Jeff Bezos, his brother, and Wally Funk, one of the Mercury 13 women who tested to be an astronaut. That seat sold for $28 million.
Right.
That's a lot.
Huge disparity. Yeah.
Yeah.
So and Blue Origin used that money to basically give 19 different charities $1 million each. Jeff Bezos just gave the Smithsonian $200 million in a gift for STEM education and science and the museum's refurbishment. But we don't know how much the actual seats are going to cost, right? Because Jeff Bezos most likely not going to be on every flight. And so I think that's kind of the question that we want to see. For SpaceX, a trip to orbit, we know that a rocket launch costs on the average between $62 and maybe $70 million. That's kind of what they sell those flights for. Probably more with insurance and then also more if you're going to have food, life support. You got to pay for that air and that water. NASA, you know, themselves also have kind of breakdown costs for what that stuff is going to cost. And so we don't really know exactly how much that. And Jared Isaacman, the billionaire that bought this Inspiration 4 mission that's launching in September, is not telling either. So, I should also point out that while we've been talking about these, there is another billionaire, Yusaki Maezawa in Japan, who has put down some kind of a down payment or bought an entire Starship flight, which is SpaceX's mega rocket that they're building in South Texas. And that one is to go around the moon. And we don't know how much that costs either. But if they're launching a mission around the moon, it must be in the billions. So those are kind of the pay scale. You go from $250,000 to at least $28 million if you really want a super high tech with the richest man on the planet, to some sort of subset of $60 to $70 million to go to orbit.
Like Bond villain territory to the upper end.
To billions of dollars to go around the moon. So that's where we are right now, Shailen.
My main question is just what does this all mean? Right? Because the last space race between, you know, Russia and America was mainly for what? National pride, to see who gets there first, who could like lead in technology following in the post-war era. This one is rich people hanging out in space. So I fail to get as excited, I guess, reading about like NASA's innovations back in the day. But what is Virgin Galactic trying to accomplish here versus what Blue Origin is and what SpaceX is? I feel like they have very different goals, right? Like Blue Origin's was always about more than just space tourism, whereas Virgin Galactic was space tourism as the impetus, right?
That's right. In fact, I think at the core, because these are companies, they want to be able to have a product that they can sell to make money. But they do have all three of them, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, and SpaceX, have very different missions. Now, back in the early days of space travel, you have this race between then the United States and the USSR, where both countries want missiles, they want rockets, they want to be able to launch weapons everywhere. And to do that, you need really powerful rockets. So that is really kind of the impetus of where that came from. It was national security. It was national pride. It was just to really show what each country could do. And then they reached the moon, and then that kind of stopped. And they went kind of very divergent ways, where NASA built a space shuttle, and then then Russia built space stations, and then they're working together on a space station, and everyone wants to go back to the moon. What we see now is we see companies that see they see that there are people out there who have the means and the interest to fly in space, and they want to fill that niche. And they want to fill it in different ways, because Virgin Galactic, Richard Branson, he's known for delivering experiences with Virgin Atlantic, with music and whatnot, of a very tailored approach. Right. People know what they're going to get from that brand. So he can make a space line for passenger flight that will carry that brand into space.
High-end adventure has kind of been his brand for a while, right?
Exactly. So that's kind of where he's coming from. Now, he did say that he's always wanted to fly in space. This was a dream of his. And, while it still is a substantial amount of money, $250,000 is much less than what any other private trip to space has gone to date. And he can do it at scale now. He's building another spaceship. And the idea is to turn that into a really profitable company. They are public now, too. They did go public in this whole time. And you can see them franchising that out to maybe not just launching out of New Mexico, but they could do it from Sweden.
Right.
They could do it from Singapore.
It could be flights to these other places, right? Like not just going up and down, but going from New Mexico to Singapore or something really quickly, right?
Exactly. For again, that really high-end... We had... Virgin Galactic actually has announced plans for a new supersonic jet to kind of be the interim level to get there too. Now on Blue Origin side, Jeff Bezos, he has like a personal mission to have like a million people living in space in the future. He wants this giant, they call it an O'Neill space station. You can imagine a giant soda can like miles and miles long where people live on the inside skin of that can in time. It's purely out of science fiction, but something that is a really major goal to shoot to. And it's a very inspirational goal. And he has billions and billions of dollars in the pockets to be able to fund that. So that's where he has been coming from. And if he needs to have a profitable feeder for that dream, that's what Blue Origin is trying to do.
And isn't that the ultimate goal, though, right? It's not just putting people in a can in space. It's like, what are you going to do with those people? And I believe we've heard Jeff Bezos talk about asteroid mining before. I feel like that is the next big thing that the super rich are going to go after, because we're running out of resources here on Earth. Rare earth minerals is like a big reason we're having such a chip shortage right now. So if they can go to space and get stuff like that, is infinite money. Is that a part of it in the short term and long term?
Yeah, both Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk have said that they have kind of two different visions. Well, Elon Musk has been really singular about his. They want a place in space where humanity can live and thrive, so that there's another place in space where humanity is living and thriving. Just so that there's like a backup right now. So they would like to have a way to kind of to at least serve a part to keeping the species going if an asteroid hits, if there's some other kind of mega disaster, that kind of thing. But in order to really make that pay for itself, there is a lot of interest in mining space. Elon Musk wants to build a city on the moon or on Mars. That has been his goal from the founding of SpaceX, is he wants people He wants a colony or a settlement on Mars. And the other companies are looking at the moon, where they can use those resources that are a little closer to home, and hopefully develop new technologies to use them, to use it as a springboard to either mine those resources like you were just talking about and bring them back to Earth, or use them to build other things in space that can then drive some sort of new economy. There's a lot of talk about helium-3 on the moon. You might have heard that, where they say, oh, yeah, we can use this as a cheap nuclear fusion fuel. We can't do fusion right now, but they know that it's there. And if they can do that and make cheaper energy, then we might all be able to benefit from that.
I think, like, Blue Origin, like, it just doesn't seem like tourism is the main goal for sure. And it's kind of like what Bezos did with Amazon Web Services, in a way, investing in a cloud, right? Investing in a ton of servers before a cloud-based infrastructure and, you know, people were running systems on the cloud, like, before that really existed. And that put him in a good place to basically power the internet, right? So it seems like that's where we're kind of headed. There was a viral thread on Twitter about, like, are billionaires just planning to leave a ruined Earth? Is that what's happening here? What is your thought on that? Because I think it's a lot more complex than that. But let me know what you think, Tarek.
Yeah, I think that there is a high visibility because these are billionaires, right? That they want to get off the planet and leave us all behind. That was the whole plot of that movie Elysium with Matt Damon, right? Where everyone lived on an O'Neill cylinder space station while the rest of us were kind of scrambling around on Earth below. But I don't think that that's the case. I think that there is both a business driver to these companies, where they are very accomplished entrepreneurs in different fields. And they all have kind of been converging on this one field as the next big step to do different things. You know, for Jeff Bezos, he sees it as you mentioned, getting kind of on that ground floor to develop the infrastructure needed to a higher economy in space. He's actually been competing to offer what he calls delivery services to the moon. And Amazon is really great at that. So the odds are they're going to get there one way or another. And so, you know, we can see that they're really kind of interested in that. At the same point, they are people who have all expressed a serious desire to go to space. And so there is, I think, a driving force to have that experience.
Yeah, probably just because they can, right?
Exactly. Probably more than once, right? And if I was a billionaire and I really wanted to go to space and there was no one that could get me there and I had all of these resources, it's not a giant leap to say, you know what? If no one's going to get me there, maybe I can get myself there.
I have to ask about, I guess, the fairness of it, because you look back to the last space race, too. There was a lot of conversation about, like, hey, it's great you're spending billions of dollars, you know, beating Russia and getting people to the moon. But it seemed like, first of all, it seemed like the people going to the moon, the people going to space were basically, you know, white professionals. Everybody on Earth, the other folks in America, black and brown folks, people who weren't super rich or super like astronauts, we're still struggling to get by. We were still dealing with a lot of issues on the ground floor. Today, it seems even worse because the effects of climate change are everywhere now. Like, I just saw a news report about another heat wave coming to the Pacific Northwest. It looks just as bad as the one that hit a couple of weeks ago. The world isn't really prepared for, like, what is happening to us. Meanwhile, these billionaires are out there just, like, playing with their rockets, dumping more fuel into our atmosphere. Like, it just seems a little unfair, and maybe, like, the optics aren't so great right now. Should they be doing other things alongside this? Like, it's great Jeff Bezos gave some money to the Smithsonian. That money is going to be a tax write-off for him. You know, should he just be paying his taxes like he should? Is that a better solution? I don't know where you come down on this, Tarek.
I think it's a real fair point. And as you mentioned, this is an argument that has dogged space travel since the dawn of the space age. Why are we spending all this money in space when we could be spending it on the ground? And, you know, NASA's retort has always been every single dollar that we spend in space, we're actually spending on Earth with the people that they hire, the technology transfers that you and I are talking about. Using technology that was developed that came out of that. And then another company's like, hey, we could use this to make a video camera that you can put in a computer, you know, and talk over a satellite communication. That's really great that we have all of that stuff. It clearly has made communications better. I can't, you know, especially in this last year with where we've been in a pandemic. My family is in California and Singapore. I haven't seen them in a year and a half. And we've been able to kind of keep that connection. That's like one, NASA calls them spinoffs, that I really appreciate. But there is, for these billionaires, a very clear optics issue for where they're spending all of their money. Well, not all of it, right? It may not even be a significant portion of it.
What's in the couch for them?
They're spending all of this money on these programs. Now, Elon Musk, you know, he has his own approach where he's driving Tesla with his electric cars. He has a solar company, so he has been putting a lot of effort into that part of it because he feels that we need to have that kind of sustainable energy and consumption. A process going forward. Jeff Bezos, you know, one of the reasons he did step down from Amazon was so that he could explore other projects. And it would not surprise me if there is some sort of climate initiative that that does come out of that. But we do need to wait and see. And for Virgin Atlantic, one of the things that the earlier claims that came out in the very early days of the company was that they were going to try to have a green fuel. They've kind of backed off that a little bit. And we're sure that there are some philanthropic work. I mean, Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson have announced that they are going to be giving away flights for these trips so that they can inspire a new generation of younger people to go in space. We saw with just the makeup of the crew that diversity is kind of key to that. And we saw that also with NASA's new push to go to the moon as well. They announced a cadre of astronauts recently, and it is one of the most diverse groups that I've ever seen for any program going forward.
I think one big difference here too is like when NASA does something and they're investing so much to do future missions, it is also for the public good, right? Like it eventually helps America, it could help people all over the world. Like so much of our technology now has come out of the original space program. If that was a private space race, never would have happened.
This is really key. This is really key, too, because as a citizen or as just a member of the public, because you don't have to be a citizen, you can log on and you can request information or details from any kind of NASA-funded study and learn, you know, maybe if it's just for your own personal enjoyment, you can learn about it. NASA has these agreements that they have in place where they can share kind of their learnings from technology. These companies have all benefited from that process. So there is that very clear trade-off. One of the biggest worries for me as a reporter was that once we shifted into this commercial model, that the level of access and transparency was going to drop off a cliff. Now, we haven't seen that like completely fall off where they're doing things quietly. But, you know, when Blue Origin was developing this New Shepard vehicle, they would launch test flights and announce it months later to say, hey, look what we did, you know, because no one was able to watch them because they were off in the deep desert. Because they have contracts with NASA, because they have agreements to fly people in space, which has safety evaluations, they have to have a measure of public transparency that we can now follow to know when SpaceX is going to test their rocket in Texas near the community because they have to make announcements for that. But any new technologies that these companies develop for themselves to build these vehicles are their technologies now. And so that technology spinoff may not be as free as what we've seen with NASA. You know, we may not we may not get the super Uber like internet of the future that SpaceX's Starlink might use unless they license that for a fee. So that is something that we're going to want to watch because while right now it's just these trips to space and maybe their heat shield technology or their life support system, it, you know, as more and more people are going to be living and working in space, that's stuff that's going to govern how those folks live, how they survive in space, who's delivering the food that they might need to go into space. Or if I'm living in a remote part of the world, how I get access to the services that I need through this infrastructure that is now a licensed piece of technology by a billion-dollar company.
We'll see, and you know what? We'll be keeping an eye on all this news. I just like the skeptical side of me is like I don't trust these billionaires. I wish they were paying taxes. I wish they were like trying to help the world, especially while so many things are literally on fire. But you know what, Tarek? I'd love to have you back on as we get more news and more announcements from these folks. And we'll dive more into this down the line.
I have a sense that Tarek, you'll have greater access to some of these trips than the rest of us with your coverage and everything. So I'm sure we will interview you soon about one of these trips.
That's the one of the greatest things. I'm like the rocket person at space.com. Everyone knows that I love all the different ships. And right. it's really exciting to kind of live in a time where there isn't just one way to get into space or two from two different companies, but you've got all these different designs of ways to get into space. There's new companies coming up every time to develop something new. It is something to watch. Charlene, you're right. I need to, maybe they'll have like a coupon day.
When are you going and what will you pick as your first trip? Blue Origin or Virgin Galactic?
whoever signs me first and lets me sign the waiver. So
absolutely. So Tarek, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast. Where can we find your work on the internet these days?
Well, you can find us. Well, thank you for having us. I had a great time. I could talk about space all day.
Yeah, but, yeah, that's fine. I love talking about space.
I actually do at space.com, where you can find us and our entire team. I'm on Twitter at Tarek J. Malik as well. And you can follow space.com on Twitter and Facebook as well. So we hope to see you there.
Let's move on from space and to the cloud, specifically the Microsoft cloud. This week, Microsoft launched Windows 365, a rumored cloud PC service. We've covered it a couple of months ago, but it is a full PC. It's a Windows 10 PC that you can just subscribe to. Tell Microsoft, like, hey, you want up to eight virtual CPUs, this amount of RAM and storage, and just have a computer in the cloud. Wow. So
I love it.
It is kind of wild to me. Let me just like dive into some of this. Check out my coverage about this whole thing, because I talked with some folks from Microsoft and we got some good answers from them. But essentially, this is building on top of Azure Virtual Desktop, which is Microsoft's service for very technical folks. So people who know how to wrangle servers and how to like handle virtual machines in the cloud. People they were able to do that for a couple of years, but a normal person just saying, hey, give me a virtual PC, please. That was not possible. So this is kind of a simpler way of doing that. We don't know what the prices for this are going to be, but I think essentially for businesses, especially small businesses and enterprises, this could be a good way to, first of all, ensure data security, employees, instead of having a personal computer or an work computer, they could have a personal environment that they could access from shared devices or from their home computer. No more fighting with VPNs like we have to over here. Everybody hates VPNs. Yes. Just a computer that is always there. Apparently, it never has to shut down. It is always like available in the state it's in, so you can continue your work easily. It's supported on virtually any browser too, so you can access this on a Mac. You can access this on an Android tablet. Not hard to tell. Like,
wow.
Eventually, I can imagine like a dongle for TVs or something where you could just turn any TV or any screen into a Windows 10 or 11 PC. Like, it'll run Windows 11 when this finally launches. This is kind of a big deal. Maybe not so much for consumers, although a single consumer, you know, a business of one can also subscribe to one of these machines and have access to it. This does seem like bold new territory for Microsoft and the way we think of computers. What do you think of this, Sherlyn?
I mean, I think it's pretty exciting. And I don't know why. I'm a normie-ish, I believe. I think of myself as. And the idea of a virtual machine might not seem like, you know, crazy useful for someone who already has their own laptop that they store everything on or whatever. But like you said, the use cases for enterprise are huge. It's also the persistent state that this thing can remain in across your various devices if you have them. That's super intriguing. Plus, like you said, browser-based access. So like, again, from Android phone, you can access your Windows PC in the cloud. And if you've stored
interface is going to be like, but they've talked about tablet. So they've talked about iPad. They've talked about your Android. They never said phone specifically, but you could do it. You could do like Zooms or something. Yeah.
I also suspect that the phone thing is more of like a hack thing if you wanted to use the desktop version of a site on your Chrome mobile browser, whatever, right?
Probably,
But I suspect it's going to be, I'd be curious about the resource drain, about like what sort of minimum requirements to operate something like that through your browser would be.
It's so it's video streaming, you know?
Right, so exactly.
Essentially, so, these things could be run on Chromebooks. These things could be run on, like, really, really lightweight computers.
That would...
So maybe, yeah.
Insane. So then that maybe... Goodbye Parallels? Like, what...
Well, that's essentially it, right? Like, I think Parallels and VMware have been the most popular virtualization tools. Right. And Parallels was a big thing when Apple moved over to Intel chips around 2005. Parallels came out and they were like, hey, you just want to run Windows inside your Mac OS? You can virtualize it easily through our software. And I knew when I was working in IT then, I built up parallel installations for a lot of people. Because back then, Macs didn't have all the software Windows had. So a lot of professors and, you know, people I worked with wanted to have access to both types of software. It's the same thing now. Like, I think virtual machines are really useful. If you if you didn't want to install the Windows 11 beta on your main PC, but you wanted to play around with the interface and see how it looked or develop software for it, you could run it in a virtual PC, you know, and just not sacrifice your machine. So putting it in the cloud, I think, makes it even more useful. I think it's just really intriguing. Normal people don't need virtual machines, but I think technical people, especially Mac users who just like maybe occasionally will need something on Windows or maybe something their work relies on, that could be good. I could see organizations giving people Chromebooks or cheaper Windows laptops and then running these things, which will get more power over the cloud. That could be something because now the company we work for gives everybody MacBook Pros.
And well, I got a Dell Latitude something.
But essentially, like a $1,000 computer. Everybody gets a $1,000 level computer, even if they probably don't need that much power, right? So something like this, they can scale between. Microsoft told me they're right now you could configure up to 8 virtual CPUs, 16 gigabytes of RAM, 512 gigabytes of storage. Actually, maybe 256 at launch. But they're also working on dedicated GPUs, so you can also get like GPU processing power. This whole thing kind of came about from their early attempts at like building gaming virtualization too. So they say this is fast enough for video. They're working on tech that will like render the video locally but still stream it through the virtual machine. This could be really cool. I don't know, folks, but it's launching on August 2nd, so we'll see.
An interesting question from the chat that I thought I'd bring up on our podcast too. Jojope or JojoP asked, does it already include Office on there?
I don't know. That's a good question, actually. All I know is it's a virtual PC. Maybe if Microsoft were smart, they would just give you everything. But from what I hear, this is not tied to your it's not tied to your Windows account. So it's like a completely separate thing. And your subscription fee basically includes a Windows license as part of it. Maybe they could have multiple tiers. Like, hey, you want Office in here too?
Right.
It probably would be smart for them to just give you Office if you get one of these. Yeah.
Yeah, it should be. But no, this is pretty exciting news for sure.
to a certain person, it's very exciting. Yeah. I wish I had this when I was an IT guy, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll definitely be following Windows 365. I have not played with it yet, but I'm hoping to closer to August as we get there. But listen, apparently a lot of people love Windows. So I'm glad people have been checking out this coverage. Stay tuned for more on Windows 365 and certainly Windows 11. I cannot wait to get final software on that.
Oh, yeah.
Let's move on to some other news. Sherlyn, I know you had something you really want to dive into.
Speaking of non-Apple software, Android 12 Beta 3 arrived this week.
What a
week.
Sexy name. Yeah.
What? Yeah, I know. Well, listen, they're all beta names are all sexy as hell. Android 12 Beta 3 rolled out this week. And what's interesting now, I mean, one of the features it brings is scrolling screenshots. Hooray. But sort of almost buried a little bit further down Google's announcement post was that it's bringing enhanced auto-rotation. That's in Google's words. But really what this feature does is instead of just relying on your accelerometer and gyroscope to figure out how you're holding up your phone, it's actually going to tap your camera to see your face and be like, oh, you know, this person's holding up the phone in a landscape mode because their eyes are here and their nose is here, et cetera, right? So it's a camera-based auto-rotation tool to, I guess, complement what already exists to make auto-rotate a bit faster, but also a bit more accurate for instances when you're lying on your couch, you're, I don't know, doing, holding a plank and somehow still looking at your phone. I don't know. I can't think of many other use cases than lying on your couch and in your bed. But yeah, so it's really looking, and it could just make that auto-rotate a bit more accurate too.
So but, is this for like if you're shooting a video and you want to know if you're actually in TikTok mode versus YouTube mode? Like, is that what's happening? Or is
it's just
more viewing?
It's not, it could be for both, but I think personally for me, when I use auto-rotate, it's for viewing, right? So like when you flip your phone over to maximize the YouTube screen, or when you're using an app and or a browser, you know, and you want to see the website wider or something, and you flip your phone. I mean, that's how I imagine the use case would be. But also, yeah, it could totally be used for when you're shooting something. It's I think it's weird if you were shooting I don't think it'd be able to auto-rotate using your camera if your camera was already in use for something else.
Right. I just I feel like we're going to have a long walk this year towards you trying to make Android 12 seem like an interesting or exciting update.
You're so mean to Android 12. Material U is really exciting. I will say I've been living with
Material U.
Yeah. I've been living with the Android 12 beta and the iOS 15 betas. I could go deep into like the differences between Android and iOS as main devices, but I will say that there are some quirks I'm not a big fan of. This thing though, camera-based auto rotation here might give people some discomfort because it is, you know, using your camera, it is looking for your face. But Google did say that, you know, all this is happening in its private compute core, so the images are not being stored anywhere and they're not sent anywhere. They're really just, you know, temporarily being used to see how you're holding your phone up. So hopefully that gives some people some assurance. I'd love to see if they enable, like they give people the option to kill or not use this. And also it'll only be available on Pixel 4 and older. Pixel 4 and newer. So it requires some sort of higher end hardware. Anyhow, Beta 3 has some other features that I go into detail on our article on Engadget.com. You can check it out there. Yeah, I mean, if you already have the beta, cool. If not, this is just a tease of what's coming up when beta Android 12 rolls out. Yeah.
You also covered the Biden executive order from last week that covered big tech and net neutrality and right to repair and a bunch of different things. So what's going on there? You know, what's your big takeaway? Because it seems very exciting just to have actual right to repair rules.
I know it's I drafted a tweet in my head and never posted this, but okay. So this is an executive order that Biden signed on Friday, and it's huge. It's got like something like 72 different suggestions and actions, spanning a dozen federal agencies, including the FTC, FCC, etc., and big tech companies. So a lot of the what's relevant to Engadget here are things that are about tech companies and anti-competitive behavior, antitrust, and net neutrality. One thing that Biden in the executive order suggested, I mean, it's all suggestions right now, right? Until they like work with the agencies to make all of that happen. But it asked the FCC to restore net neutrality rules that were undone by the prior administration. Not naming names here, guys, but yeah. You know, and also important things. My main takeaway is that like Biden and his team and his administration were like listening to all the common complaints people have about unnecessary early termination fees.
And they have smart people like on the FTC now who can like bring a lot of these topics up. Yeah,
exactly. So things that are being addressed here are like I said, the early termination fees, excessive fees, anti-competitive behavior, like, you know, Lena Khan's been in the news a lot lately. So, you know, this is something that she's been talking about too, I think. But also the order also asked the FTC to establish rules on surveillance and accumulating data, and letting you do your own repairs of your devices and equipment, not just in tech, but also in agriculture and farming, where people want the right to repair their John Deere equipment or their tractors. Yeah.
That's kind of where all this started, is because farmers and agriculture are used to repairing big machines. These aren't like, these are like old school you know, vehicles. It's not like cars where there are tons of microchips and stuff now. It's really hard to repair. A tractor has kind of worked the same way for a while. So, hey, right. This is good. I hope we can right. stick with this.
Mm-hmm. So I think this, if anything, this executive order, of course, it'll take some time before all of the actions come to pass. But yeah. I do think it shows an understanding of what's broken in the system here. They talk about things like, in the transportation section, they talk about airlines asking for more transparency and disclosure over baggage fees, change fees, cancellation good. Fees, and, you know, asking airlines to give clearer guidelines on mm-hmm. when it will issue refunds for things like not working Wi-Fi or in-flight entertainment.
There are so many phishing, there are really fishy things a lot of big companies get to deal with. I'll tell you guys a quick story. Natural gas in Georgia mm-hmm. is an unregulated market. So it's insane. It is the mm-hmm. Wild West. There are like a ton of companies I could potentially subscribe to, but they do this thing where if you don't subscribe to a fixed rate, they do a thing that they say they send you on a variable gas rate, which could easily be 5 to 10 times more, but they don't tell you. Like, it's very untransparent. So basically over the weekend, my gas bill shot up like 5 times. Jesus. I was like, what is happening? They never mentioned that things had shifted. And I called in to fix that and get a lower rate. It took 3 months for that to apply. Meanwhile, they could like keep charging me at the higher rate. There's so many things going on with all sorts of companies and industries in America where it's just like unfair and insane. So I hope we can like do something about this. Yeah.
Yeah. So this covers industries like healthcare as well, where we know and have talked about before the infrastructure in America is really broken. So let's see how this plays out. We will keep an eye on it. But let's talk about things that people need and want and complain about, right? The Apple macOS Monterey beta.
Right, which I previewed,
You previewed. You hated one thing about the Safari redesign, DaVinci. Tell the
world. I didn't necessarily hate, but it was not great. So they simplified Safari by basically shoving the tabs and the menus and everything up to one toolbar at the top of the screen. But very quickly, like after 6 or 7 tabs, they would just become meaningless, like hard to read. They would just be little icons. That's something that happens on every computer, but it usually takes me like 10 to 15 tabs, you know, especially on a MacBook. So that was crazy. And I didn't think they could stick with that. And apparently they're not, right?
Yeah. They're bringing it back. They're no longer getting rid of it by default. Or just fully getting rid of it. They're bringing it back. Now it's back by default, and you have the option to hide.
So there is a tabs bar now below the address bar, which allows more room to show tabs, because we're all tabs addicts. Come on. Yes. What do you think? Yes. What do you think we are, Apple?
We did Marie Kondo our browsers? Come on.
They're like, we give you tab groups. Just organize all your stuff into tab groups. Nobody wants to do that. We're lazy, and we just fill our browsers until they can't take it anymore. Then we open a new window, and we do it again, because we're monsters.
Recategorize all of that, restart all of that. I have session managers for this reason. So that was a nice thing to see Apple kind of take heed and change while it is still in a beta rollout situation or beta testing situation. So, you know, when macOS Monterey does eventually officially launch.
It was the same guy who was like, we got to put the mouse charging cable at the bottom of the mouse, people. It is the cleanest, most beautiful, most design-friendly way. Like that, Apple sometimes makes those boneheaded decisions that's just for design. Like, this looks great in a screenshot when we show it at WWDC. But actually using it, no.
Now,
give us something fun, Trillin. I know you had a fun story.
Speaking of wacky design ideas, Tag Heuer, we all know and love this company for its connected line of smartwatches that costs $1,800 or more. These are Wear OS watches with the Tag Heuer branding that cost $2,000. Anyhow, this week the company collaborated with Nintendo to make a Super Mario themed version of its connected smartwatch. So
this looks really good.
It does look nice. I'll give you that. Really. But if you're a Super Mario fan, it will cost $2,150 for a Tag Heuer Mario connected watch running Wear OS with some of the
and they're only making 2,000 of these, so it's not like it's gonna get cheaper. It's only gonna get rarer, basically.
It's a limited supply. It's available today And okay, so I mean, do I really? So okay, in addition to what, like M embossed or engraved in the knob and on the underside and on the clasp, you know, some sort of those hardware touches. Mm-hmm. You also see customized watch faces that feature Mario and Mario Universe items like the mushroom, some of the floating elements in the titles and stuff like that. You'll have four new watch faces to choose from. Sure. The other thing they're doing is using Mario to encourage you to stay active because this is what I thought was so funny when I wrote it.
Every time you jump, because I would tend with that.
It wouldn't. Yeah. I don't think it says it out loud, but it does like have.
Does it play a Mario running noise when you run real fast? Like I would kind of love that.
To be clear, I haven't seen this in person. They were supposed to show me one in person. Still haven't.
This is from a line of watches, by the way, that starts at $1,800. So this starts, initially, this entire line that Takahara was dealing with is far more than the Apple crazy leather one, right?
Well, yeah. When it first came out, this line started at $2,000. The $1,800 is a price dip that just started recently.
The Apple Watch, the Series 5 Hermes Apple Watch costs $1,500. So this is like a level of smartwatch world that I just never want to deal with.
It is tag. It's really just tag. It's the whole watch world. It's not even just a smart watch. It's a watch world, right? There's a lot of watches out there that cost a ton of money. And this is firmly in that, like almost not a Rolex level, but, you know, sort of that world. Anyhow, the animations, they if you achieve your steps goals on 25, 50, 75, and 100% throughout the day, you'll get different animations. You get like the superstar, the super mushroom, the gold pole, etc. I mean, that's pretty much it. The watch faces and these animations and the hardware that I discussed earlier, they are your distinction from the regular Tag Heuer Connected. Which, by the way, the company was also like, we might consider making these watch faces and animations available on other editions of the Tag Heuer Connected at a later stage.
Why? This should be an Apple watch face. Like, just give me an Apple Watch face with Mario characters. That's all. I spent way too much money for my Apple Watch Series 4 when that came out. And I want some new character watch faces, please. Okay.
You know, you never know. Nintendo should do that. But when Tag Heuer pitched me this, they were like, we're teaming up with a Japanese cartoon character. I'll say, Pokemon, Pikachu! But no, it's Mario. Which is also
okay, a Pikachu watch face, I think could do really well.
Yeah.
And if you sit too long, it'll jolt you.
Yeah. If you need okay. to
move. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. I'd be down. So
please stand up, Jolt. Okay. Let's move on to what we've been working on. What we've been working on. I am still working on the Vive Pro 2 review because I have had no time. I did finish my Vive Focus 3 review, which I found to be like a good standalone headset. To be honest, a very comfortable and high quality one. But that thing is $1,300. And no, don't buy that. If you can get the Oculus Quest 2 for $300, Vive is strictly for businesses right now. So cool tech, but not for you. I'm also testing out the 2021 Prius Prime as a family car. I want to get like more hands-on time with the new electrics or plug-in and hybrids as this is. So this has like 30 to 35 miles of electric drive along with a normal gas engine. So I'm enjoying it so far. As a family car, though, I think it kind of fails. And I'll get into that in my eventual coverage. The trunk is tiny, and this thing could barely fit one car seat. So, you know, this is why parents typically go for bigger cars, I think. You got so much junk with kids.
So
you got strollers, you got bags, you got things you just got to carry around at all times. Sherlyn, what are you working on?
I am, well, in addition to everything I talked about, all those stories, By the end of this podcast, you'll see on the Engadget website a story I've been working on about accessibility as well. I am still sort of under embargo, so I'm not going to give you more details than that, but please do check out Engadget.com shortly. It's fun. And then, hey, next week I will be off on some break, some time off, and I am looking forward to it. It doesn't mean that I'm prepping some work ahead of time for that week because
to do before every vacation is do extra work.
Exactly. And then after, when you come back, is to climb back up on top of the pile. Yes. Yep. But there you go.
Enjoy your time off, Sherlyn. Everybody, tell Sherlyn how to relax, please. You can tweet at her. Give her some suggestions and shows.
I think. Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like if I leave you, if I say relax, you will find the a game to play for 12 hours straight without eating or sleeping. Yeah.
It's true. Which I've given fine. Up on Wheel of Fortune, sure. But it pissed me off too much. Yes.
Let's move on to our pop culture picks. How about that? Yes. What are you taking a break with now, pop culture wise?
Yeah. So, I mean, it changes. But anyhow, a few things to shout out before I give you my actual recommendation. One, this movie called Coda that we saw around the time of Sundance is now released on Apple TV Plus. Y'all should check it out.
No. Coda is coming August 13th. I will not let you do another one of those Hill House things.
Okay, it's coming on August 13th.
You can play
Apple
the trailer
Plus.
On okay, Apple okay. TV Plus right now. But that's what it's asking you to play. Yeah.
Okay. Keep an eye out for it, August 13th, yes. on Apple TV Plus.
And you watched
like
it, right?
Like we said before, I watched it at Sundance. And Coda stands for a section in music, but also stands for Child of Deaf Adults. Adults. So it's really, really an important story to tell too. I think in this country or in this world, also kind of a typical coming of age story. So. Mm-hmm. And then shout out that Loki was awesome. So there you go.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, we can talk about it next time. But
that'll require a spoiler cast. But that was a pretty good finale.
Yeah, we won't
finally,
do that. Yeah.
An MCU TV series has a good ending. Because I think certainly Captain Falcon and the Winter Soldier fell apart.
Yeah.
Immediately. Yeah. And then WandaVision hit or miss, I think, for the ending. But I like most of WandaVision. Yeah, Loki was just great throughout. Yeah.
Loki was nonstop great. Anyhow, so my actual recommendation, though, this is one that Davinder's going to laugh at me for because it's debatable how good this is. So we were talking about all these like post-Lost TV shows. Are very,
you
like,
talk about Manifest?
No, I've already talked about Manifest. Yeah. Now, after I finished Manifest, I had to find another show in the similar thread or similar style.
You had to, or because there was a gun to your head.
Because that was like, no, I wanted to. So I found on Hulu this show called Debris.
Another one word just like thing
random.
Happening
in Debris. Yeah. listen to what's happening in Debris.
I know what's happening in Debris, but
okay an alien spacecraft was seen or captured through a space camera or something floating near Earth or just zooming by Earth. But then the debris from that ravaged spacecraft has been dropping down to our planet for the months after. And
it's
they all
cool
have special properties. Yeah. Yes, it's a very cool concept. Science fiction wise, what an interesting concept. But they all
I watched
have...
the pilot for this, but it's
I know. It's kind of, I've read some of the reviews for it that I agree with, which is that they're building a story between the characters that actually doesn't play out that effectively. They should have just focused on the episodic, hey, here's the mystery of the week in the very similar
suck.
Style of Fringe.
They're just not interesting.
They're just too caught up in their own ennui.
Boring. Yeah.
It's annoying a little bit for that. So I skip all of that and I just watch it for the mystery because they do come up with these clever scenarios. It's hard to watch a movie, a show that kind of like does itself dirty like this. But I mean, it's...
It's hard to watch, but you will keep watching. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, I love the science fiction of it. But I just ignore the character talky bits.
Did you ever watch Sherlyn, the original, like the X-Files? Did you ever watch original X-Files back in the day?
Yeah. Well, not back in the day. I watched it like a few years ago. And
that first season of X-Files, I feel like everybody compares everything to Lost, but it's really that first season of X-Files and the way they built those characters and the mystery and the episodic stuff. Like, I think everything has tried to like mimic that in certain ways. Yeah.
Speaking of Lost, I also just started watching season one onwards, like in order, because I used to just watch it when it was on TV. So now I'm on Lost. So there you go. Anyway, how about you? What are you telling people to watch? I saw your recommendation and I agreed with it.
A couple of things. Yeah, you'd probably like. I started watching Wellington Paranormal, which is this fun show. It is on HBO Max. It is a spinoff.
I saw the trailer.
Of What We Do in the Shadows, that fun New Zealand horror movie that has its own TV adaptation right now. But I think the TV adaptation of What We Do in the Shadows is a little more American, like a little more like overtly funny. This show is more like dry New Zealand humor. And I'm kind of digging it. It is just like two cops. They specifically call themselves Mulder and Scully, who go around in like a, mockumentary style, but go around solving supernatural mysteries. You know, there's potential like ghosts, there's potential people being possessed and vampires and whatnot all around this New Zealand town. Is really chill. Apparently this show's from like 2018 and it only recently came to HBO Max, so yeah, it's good. I dig it.
I just saw this thing appear on screen. I didn't realize Taika Waititi was involved.
I mean, it's his series, yeah.
He's involved,
But it's very much New Zealand style dry humor. It's not like the American show that is a lot more like, I think, overtly funny and has like just more going on. It's like sharper writing. Anyway, I'm digging Wellington Paranormal. I'm also watching this new anime series called Godzilla Singular Point. This is my like, I guess I've given up Sherlin type of show. In that it is listen, I saw the trailer for this and I saw Godzilla. I saw really good animation. Bones is one of the animation studios, and they've been involved like with some of my favorite shows over the years. So it is about two like young adults. One is a researcher, I think like a researcher of like paranormal type events, and the other is somebody who's helping to develop this robot thing, who's also like exploring these extraterrestrial or intraterrestrial creatures. It's a Godzilla show where Godzilla doesn't show up until like halfway through the entire season. But I think it's really interesting because it takes like an Evangelion approach to, how would science, like how would actual scientists like go about finding creatures like this? You get some of the like traditional Godzilla creatures, but they don't look the same. There's a lot of like metaphysics involved. The show's written by somebody who basically used to be an engineer, so it's like really technical and detailed at times too. So I'm digging it. Sometimes I just want my giant monsters, and I think this is a good one. Even if Godzilla is not in it much, it's a really good looking show, so I just want to shout it out for that. Like, finding good anime is hard these days. I also watched The Tomorrow War. And we did a spoiler review on the Slash Film Cast for that. This show is dumb. Like, this movie is really dumb. It's really dumb, but it's competently made, right? Like, it is
enjoyably dumb to me. Like, I thought it was enjoyable.
It's skillfully made to a certain degree. So you're like, sure, it's always like making you feel dumb as an audience member. But I think the set pieces look good. The monsters look good. I hate Chris Pratt in this. A lot of things still don't make sense. Like, the actual setup of this entire world doesn't make sense. But what I've realized watching this, this is a movie where people from the future come to the past to tell people to come fight our future wars, because apparently you're just going to sacrifice yourself for the future. Nothing makes sense. But one little spoiler thing I will say here is that this is basically the Terminator future transport in like hyperdrive, right? They can like transport groups of people back and forth, but when they send people into the future, they just like drop them into the middle of nowhere. So like funny. Half of the people they transport back just die because you've been transported 50 feet into the air off the side of a building. You just die. That's it. That's your contribution to the Tomorrow War. It is also kind of funny. It's basically like, it is Player Unknown Battlegrounds, the movie, because they also send like just random people dressed in their like office work equipment, you know, just like in their business clothes to go fight the future war. So it looks hilarious and it's kind of dumb. It's a video game movie, but it's also incredibly dumb. And I just could not.
Did you like the, one of my favorite moments was near the end where like Chris Pratt just shouts, "Die!" I was just like, yes, that was like, oh my God, so stupid, but so good.
Very dumb. Very dumb. Everybody watch Wellington Paranormal. That is my best suggestion so far this week. Anything else you want to add? Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of a movie that was previously recommended on this show that we've since seen, I watched Stowaway that you recommended a long time ago or a few weeks ago, Devendros. It was not the movie I was expecting, but it was pretty good. Definitely. Like,
unexpected drama. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we should have asked Tarek about that, because that show, that movie also tried to be very accurate in terms of what it was reading.
Well, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter and at The Filmcast. We have changed our name. We are now just The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com. You can find us on Audioboom and on Patreon. We've had an amicable separation from Flashfilm.com, but check us out. We're going independent, baby.
If you want to tell me how to relax and are prepared for me to ignore you all week next week, I'm at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.
Thanks again to our sponsor, Mouser Electronics. Not only does Mouser stock the world's widest selection of semiconductors and electronic components, they also offer an original content series called Empowering Innovation Together. Each month, EIT takes a deep dive into the hottest tech trends, and this month, the focus is on AI and edge computing. Check out podcasts, articles, infographics, video, and more at mouser.com/empowering-innovation.